Hello everybody and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz and joining me today, as always, is Clinton Matos.
Hello everybody.
And Robin Lichetti.
Howdy.
How you guys doing this week?
It's very hot. It's very uncomfortable, but won't complain too much.
Trump is gone!
Brendan, if we had the rights, we could play the crab song. Trump's gone. Anyway.
Well, I mean, he's not gone. He's just no longer the US president. So I have no doubt that we'll hear from him again. Maybe a new season of The Apprentice or...
Didn't he say he's running in 2024 or something?
Yep.
I mean, he's still got that matter of the second impeachment that he earned himself. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. But let's not talk too much about orange Cheeto people that are no longer in office. Clinton, what have you got for us this week?
Yes, there is a new Raspberry Pi out called the Raspberry Pi Pico. And there's a few things that make this especially different compared to the other Raspberry Pi products in the past. This is less a story about the Raspberry Pi Pico itself and all about the Raspberry Pi chip that they created, which is called the RP2040. Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
I disagree. I think it's very succinct.
Basically, the RP2040 is a specially made piece of silicon that the Raspberry Pi Foundation in the UK made to their specifications. And what they really wanted to do is make a chip that could be used in microcontrollers. And that's what the Raspberry Pi Pico is. Instead of thinking of the Pico as an all-contained computer, think of it as a microcontroller. And then the RP2040 is the brains of that microcontroller. In the announcement, they even call the Pico a breakout board instead of, say, a maker board or a computer. And it is really cheap. Overseas, it is $4. In the one issue of a magazine that is on sale in the US, you can actually just get the Pico attached to the front cover, which is really cool. Here in South Africa, it is also very cheap. It is 69 Rand and 90 cents.
Nice.
You may be saying, isn't that more than $4? Yes, but you have to remember that $4 doesn't include tax. If you look at the British price, again, the Raspberry Pi Foundation is based in the UK. And the prices we have in South Africa are usually very close to the UK. It's £3.60, which is around 73 Rand 33, which is very close to 69 Rand 90. So, I mean, we're talking about a few Rand here or there. What can you even buy with 10 Rand? I mean, I wrote in the story, most chocolate bars are like 12 or 13 Rand. So it's not here nor there. It's not like the Nintendo Switch where we
and you can't use a chocolate bar as a microcontroller either. So
I'm sure someone's tried. So it's very impressive. It's in South Africa, which is exciting. You know, our country and our continent is always looking for cheap computing for all variety of things. And we're very excited to see what people do with this. Again, in the official announcement, they kind of talk about the mindset behind this. And they said, the lowest power, cheapest board that we made before this was the Raspberry Pi Zero, but even that for certain applications used too much power.
Wow.
And they said when they were looking at projects that people have done, they saw that they were taking the Raspberry Pi Zero to be the kind of brains of whatever application they have, and then they were connecting it to a microcontroller anyway. So they thought, why don't we just skip that and make a microcontroller of our own? And what's really interesting is a lot of companies are taking the chip, the RP2040, and they are making their own breakout boards. And what's especially interesting is Arduino, who, you know, in conversation, you're talking about if you want to make a maker project, it's usually a Raspberry Pi or an Arduino. It's very tongue-twisty today. They are making their own maker board with the RP2040 as the brains. So it's going to be very weird where you can get a product that is half Arduino, half Raspberry Pi. It would be like, I don't know, it would be like Intel putting out a CPU and they're like, oh yeah, AMD made half of the CPU. It's very strange. But again, the world of Raspberry Pi and Arduino and makers are all about stuff being open source and everyone working together. So it's not too surprising. It's just really interesting.
Yeah.
And I'll put a link. Sorry, Bryn.
Yeah, it's a pretty robust-looking little board. I mean, it's got clock and timer, temperature sensor on the board itself. Like, this is a really cool little computer.
Yeah, and as always, they make a lot of what they call them breakout boards and hats. it's still funny to me that they call them hats. Hats are just other boards that you can connect to this one. And you can pick it up locally in South Africa from a company called Pie Shop, $69.90, like I said. I was updating the stock count here. They have more than 2,000 boards available for people to buy, so there's a lot.
Cool.
You can't buy more than 50. I don't know why someone would want to buy more than 50 of these things. I just saw, yeah, this product has a limit set to 50 per order. I don't know why you'd want to buy 50, but I mean, you can, and it wouldn't even be that expensive because they're only $70 each. So that's the Raspberry Pi Pico. Check out all the information about it, and we'll probably see Doom running on it within the week.
Very nice. Moving on to bigger computers, or not really, I suppose it's slightly related to computers. Valve, as well as Bandai Namco, Capcom, Focus Home, Koch Media, and ZeniMax have all been handed fines by the European Commission for breaching European antitrust rules. The problem here seems to stem from Valve. So stick with me here because it's a bit convoluted. So the European Commission explained that Valve and the other firms that I mentioned agreed to distribute titles on Steam. Publishers would give Valve keys to distribute on Steam, and Valve would give the publishers Steam keys. So if they, for instance, sell physical discs or digital editions of the game elsewhere, they can be redeemed on Steam. The problem is that these keys were geo-locked. So if you purchased a game in country A, you can redeem it in country B. So this seems very usual for us here in South Africa. But in the EU, this is a problem because it basically prevents cross-border transactions in Europe, which is something that the EU prides itself on. As a result, all of these companies were fined, with ZeniMax actually getting the highest fine of 1.6 64 million euros. Valve, however, didn't get a discount or a reduction for cooperating, because apparently Bandai Namco, Capcom, Focus Home, Koch Media, and ZeniMax all helped with the investigation into this matter. Helped the EU Commission, obviously, and Valve didn't. However, Valve told Eurogamer this week that it refutes that statement. It did help with the investigation, and it's going to appeal the ruling. This is a very interesting case, I think, because, I mean, it kind of goes to show how rules in some parts of the world don't really work in other parts of the world. And we're going to get to that in the later parts of our podcast today. But I think that's very interesting to see how this has played out, especially with Valve being this really big entity and the EU saying, no, sorry, the way you're doing business doesn't work for us. Valve said that less than 3% of their titles are geo-locked and none of its own titles are geo-locked. But yeah, I mean, they breached the rules, apparently, according to the European Commission. And now they're going to have to pay. Obviously, Valve is appealing, but it doesn't seem like the other five companies are. But yeah, keep an eye on this one. See if anything comes of this, if any other companies are fined or if this happens again. Let's see. I do wonder if Valve is going to remove geo-locking completely, though I don't see that happening, primarily because if a game is cheaper in, for instance, let's just say Lithuania, I can see a lot of people going and purchasing the game suddenly from Lithuania and then going back to their country where they can play it. Obviously, this is all online. I don't think anybody's actually going to get in the plane, go to Lithuania, open their laptop and buy a game. I mean, VPNs and stuff make it really trivial to make it appear as if you're in somewhere else in the world. But yeah, that's what's happening with Valve and the European Commission. Yeah. Robin,
what's hilarious is that the fines are, I mean, they're a lot of money. They're probably more money than like the three of us combined will ever see in our lives.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money, but for Valve and these companies, it's peanuts.
I mean, for Bandai, like just for instance, Bandai Namco got a fine of 340,000 euros, which is nothing. I mean, yeah, even if they broke the, I hear you that they broke the rules, but is that the biggest fine you're going to give them? I mean, what do they have to sell? 5 copies of Devil May Cry 5 Special Edition?
I'm pretty sure Valve makes the cost of the fine in like a few minutes, especially during like a sale. They can recoup that money instantly. Valve is probably opposing the decision, not because of the amount of the fine, probably just, you know, for PR and so they don't get a fine in the future if they win the court case. I'm almost certain they care 0% about the actual amount of the fine.
Yeah.
Even if it was a few million euros. Valve is a $1 billion company and the biggest platform on PC. Yeah. Sorry, you wanted to go into Robin's section.
Yes, Robin.
Just hilarious.
What do you have for us this week?
Yeah, so some interesting news out of South Korea. LG, as we all know, they're a smartphone manufacturer, but they may not be for very long. So earlier this week, an internal memo was circulated amongst LG employees with the CEO, and apologies if I am butchering your name, Kwon Bong-seok. He sent out an internal memo that kind of touched on the plans for their mobile division in 2021. And he said that since the competition in the global market for mobile devices is getting fiercer, it is about time for LG to make a cold judgment and the best choice. He went on to say that the company is considering all possible measures, including sale, withdrawal, and downsizing of the smartphone business. So it came as a slight shock, I guess. LG's powers as far as a top vendor within the smartphone market has waned. In recent years, it's really struggled to compete with the likes of Samsung, who throw a lot of money at the marketing side of things. Huawei were also quite aggressive in that regard. And a lot of Chinese smartphone makers have been really aggressive as far as pricing of their devices goes. So LG, and I think you probably also lumped Sony into the same category, mm-hmm. have fallen down the ranks. So I guess the decision doesn't really take us by surprise, but it was quite interesting that they are looking at their mobile business and what it could look like moving forward. It was interesting purely for the fact that they showcased a rotable OLED display at CES earlier this month, and that was really smartphone specific as far as its application. They also have, for example, the LG Wing, which is recently launched in South Africa as a flagship device. So it will be really interesting to see what kind of direction LG takes. They could, for example, like Mr. Kwon Bong-seok was saying, they could downsize and perhaps focus on a specific segment of the market. They could also, for example, focus on displays. They're one of the leading display manufacturers in the world. So kind of focusing on that for smartphones moving forward, we're seeing a lot of more interesting form factors. That's also an option. So yeah, it will be interesting to see what decision is being taken moving forward. And I think for consumers more specifically, if you have purchased a new LG device, what that means after sales in terms of repairs, or getting your accessories, et cetera. Yeah. So interesting times ahead for LG.
I have an idea for LG. Here's what they should do. They should take a smartphone and just make a smartphone. That's all they need to do. It doesn't need to flip. It doesn't need to like have attachments to it. It doesn't need to bend slightly. It just needs to be a smartphone. Because when LG makes a good smartphone, it's really good. But then they go and add all this superfluous stuff to it that nobody cares about. And then they wonder why they are losing grip on the market. Like, just make good phones. You are good at that. Stop trying to make silly things.
But what are they going to market the phone with then? We can't just say, hey, we made a phone.
Yeah, but they can make a good phone. This is the thing, is that like Samsung doesn't do like, okay, sure, they have the folding phones and stuff, but like they don't deviate from in terms of the S series and the Note series. You don't all of a sudden see a Note that like flips 90 degrees or the screen rotates 90 degrees and reveals a numpad, because nobody wants that. They just want a phone that works.
Yeah, I think the last good LG phone that I can remember is probably the G3 from like, what, 6 years ago?
Mm.
And then they went into that modular, I think it was the G4, the G5.
Yeah.
So they've really like been quite erratic as far as the strategies go. I think, like you said, kind of distilling it and really just focusing on one element, making sure it's a really good phone, I think it'll stand them in good stead. I think to try and do too many things is obviously not working for me.
I mean, the likes of LG and Sony have pretty much handed Samsung dominance of the market on a silver platter. Because, I mean, Huawei was fetching for that spot, but then it's the whole entity list with Trump happened and they don't have access to Google services. So LG could have taken that spot, but they just gave it to Samsung, in my opinion, at least. I'm not saying that this is gospel truth, but in my opinion, from what I've seen, it just really looks like they just missed the boat completely. Like, I don't know. And the worst part is that I've used LG phones in the past, and when it is just a normal phone, it's really, really good. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that they're probably better than Samsung phones. But no, let's just make things like the Wing. What? Why? I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully we don't have another HTC on our hands.
Yeah, yeah. Shit, I miss HTC. Those were good phones.
I would have thought this would have befall Sony before LG.
You think?
I also, on top of all of this that we've discussed, I literally do not know a single person who owns an LG phone. Not one.
So I think Sony's got Japan covered. They also have a pretty strong European followership. Yeah. With LG, they're competing in South Korea with Samsung. So it's like,
yeah,
you're going up against the biggest company.
Right. Let's move on to our neighbors in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia. I'm going to not try and do an Australian accent, but I can't promise anything.
It's hilarious because they also make fun of our accents, but let's not get into that. It'll only cause a fight.
Yes, let's not. Robin, do you want to kick us off here with what's happening in Australia?
Yeah, so this, I guess, started towards the end of last year. So the Australian government, and more specifically, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC, they put together a draft bill, and that was called the News Media Bargaining Code. And it was kind of brought about as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was reported that more than 100 smaller or local news publications had shut down as a result of the pandemic, and even more journalists lost their jobs as a result. So the government had to have a look at this and kind of see what can be done about it. And this bargaining code essentially tries to give the publishers more power when it comes to dealing with entities like Google and Facebook. Google in particular has kind of pushed back on this code. The actual draft bill itself is quite dense, but to kind of just give you the cliff notes, it's essentially asking that Google pay for advertising links to feature on publishers' content. And obviously, Google aren't really a fan of that. They're saying that if they are going to pay publishers, they should do so through the Google News platform, which was rolled out in Australia, Brazil, and Germany last year. And the Australian government is saying, is kind of sticking to their guns, and they're saying that they want to push forward with this bargaining code, and that if Google wants to move its services, it's doing so out of its own volition. The government isn't forcing them to do so. And now we kind of have both entities kind of at loggerheads. And this week there was a session with the Senate Economics Legislation Committee where the Google Australia and New Zealand VP, Mel Silver, was brought in to kind of discuss the issue with members of the committee and kind of laid out flat for them and said, if this version of the code were to become law, it would give us no real choice but to stop making Google search available in Australia. She then followed that up and said that this is a worst case scenario. It's not a threat, it's a reality. And to my mind, that sounds a lot like a threat. So I think that's kind of where we can kind of jump off from.
That's exactly mob speak. You know, I just started watching The Sopranos the other day and they're like, are you threatening me? It's like, no, I'm not threatening you. We're just having a conversation.
It's not a threat, it's a reality. Okay. I need a moment to digest that, because that is quite clearly a threat. Or am I wrong?
I think you're 100% right. I think Google know that they are in the position of power. I think the ministers that are involved in this committee meeting alluded to that fact as well, saying that Australians are dependent on search as a way of doing things. I also thought it was quite interesting. The VP, Mel Silver, she mentioned that the law would essentially break Google's business model. She also mentioned the fact that news queries on search only make up 1.25% of all searches. So to my mind, at least, it doesn't seem like this would impact them as far as the capabilities of search go. What it does, however, do is create a precedent. And if Australia enacts this kind of law, it will now kind of, not necessarily force, but it will pique the interest of other nations, and they will kind of start saying, listen, why are you guys having all the power when it comes to online advertising? That needs to be shared. The wealth needs to be shared a bit more with our publishers because they are dying industries.
So my first question is can Google afford to pay every single news organization in the world to feature or to to place their stories on Google search? My immediate thought is no, it can't.
Well, if this passes, right, it would only be Australian.
Yeah. But let's just stretch this out a bit and say that, okay, they bow to Australia's demands and they say, okay, cool, we'll pay news houses to feature their stuff on our search. Then other countries come and go, okay, well, that's not fair. You have to do it for ours as well. So let's assume that we are at a space now where everybody, every news organization wants to get paid. Can Google afford to do that? I don't think it can.
I think it can, but it really depends on what kind of pricing we're talking about. And again, I think it really also depends on the organization. I think larger organizations can potentially get a lot more out of this than the smaller ones. And I think that's also one of the issues that Google's kind of brought up. They mentioned specifically data sharing. The Australian government said there's going to be no data sharing whatsoever. But again, in terms of collective bargaining and things like that, larger publications are going to have a bigger say than the smaller ones. If you, for example, took this case and applied to South Africa, an organization like News24 stands a lot to gain from it, say, compared to hypertext.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I think, I guess to kind of answer your point, I think Google can afford to pay, but at the same time, I don't necessarily know if this fixes the problem as far as a disparity between different size organizations or different size publishers.
So I think the other thing that's also important to note here is, and you mentioned it, Robin, is the size of news organizations. But like, could Google not do something such as what it does with YouTube and AdSense? Like, if a certain percentage of views comes to you through Google News, then you get a percentage of revenue of Google's advertising. Could that not be something that would work?
So I think that's kind of what the Google News platform is designed to do. Again, you kind of have to platform onto Google News, and you have to kind of tie yourself into those services again, which brings up other questions as far as how data is handling those kind of things. But I think it is a better mechanism than, say, the current model that's being proposed here. Because again, like we've mentioned, bargaining is only good for larger publishers than it is for smaller ones. I think having everyone on a Google News platform is, I guess, a better way to facilitate the process.
So I'm also interested in, you know, since we're talking about slippery slopes, if this all goes through and Google makes good on their threat that they just remove search from Australia, there are the search engines, right? But what happens if after this happens, just repeating myself there, what happens if they start removing more Google services? What if after they remove search, they say, you know, for X, Y, and Z reason, no more Gmail, no more Google Maps, no more this, no more G Suite? Do you think, because if you said we're just going to remove search, that sounds to me like eventually there'll be nothing.
And I mean, search drives every single Google service essentially.
Yeah, and I don't think Australia is a big enough market where Google will really care. Is that unfair to say about it?
I think a little bit. Let's also not forget that Google Search also drives a lot of websites' internal searches, right? Like, yeah. It's not just Google.com that would be affected by a closure of search. So if you were to shut a search completely in Australia, how many websites would that break, number one? And I do kind of worry that if Google says no more search, what, like you say, Clinton, what is next? And while that doesn't seem like, oh, well, I mean, you can use other email services and other video sharing sites. I don't know what, Vimeo, maybe. But I mean, it is concerning because Google has become pretty much the center of the internet, as much as I hate to say it. But it really has. Like, I mean, Google is a verb. I don't know how much more to get this point across that Google is important.
No, 100%. If you say something, if you tell someone you're going to Bing something, meaning to search, you'll be checked into a mental institution. Mm-hmm. So I understand. And I really don't see, I mean, the webmasters of the world, they could route the Google search to a different country, or they'll make a plan, right? And you could always just use a VPN. But for the majority of people who don't know a lot about computers, to be, you know, as kind as possible without being inflammatory there, they'll just think that Google's gone. And like you said, it's the center of the internet. What will people replace it with? And how long before the Australian government would have to come back and say, okay, please come back? I think, it's very much a threat. And I think they would eventually remove everything.
I mean,
if they have to remove just search.
I'm just thinking here as we're talking, could Google just not index Australian news publications? Could that not be something that they do, like, so that these news organizations don't appear in search? I know that's really unfair, but I mean, surely it's not either you accept that we're not going to pay things or we go. It surely can't be that black and white.
And I was just thinking,
well, I think they want to probably force their hand as well.
I was thinking, why can't the Australian government just petition Google, or, you know, maybe a stronger verb there? Why can't they just sit with them and say, listen, we got a problem with what's happening in our media because of COVID and everything. Can you help us out by, maybe if somebody searches in Australia for news, you give search rank preferences to local news industries? And again, Google might fight that, because again, their business model is if you pay, you get high on the list, usually. I'm sure they would argue with that. Just do your CEO and you'll get high on the list, promise. I don't understand why the Australian government is taking this hard tack approach. It kind of sounds like the people who are putting this together aren't 100% sure how the internet works. And again, I don't want to be inflammatory, I don't want to make accusations, but it doesn't sound like the best solution from either side, from the Australian government or from Google.
So just to answer your point there, the Google News platform would essentially do that as far as making Australian news sites preferred in terms of indexing when you search. The problem is the Australian government is saying that Google has a disproportionate influence and benefits disproportionately when it comes to online advertising, which has always been the case. I'm not too sure why now it is becoming such a issue for them. And again, I think it probably talks to what we discussed last week's AfriCast with regards to how much power these big tech firms wield. But we have given them this power.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Now it's kind of coming back to bite us in the ass. But now we're so dependent on them, and now we don't know what to do. I think that's what Australia is doing. I think they realize that they don't know what to do, and now they're going to have to stick to their guns and see who blinks first in this game of chicken.
Yeah, and it also sounds like the Australian government has a problem with how Google operates in general, and they're using news and COVID and everything as the, I don't know what to call it, the sacrificial lamb. It seems very strange the more we discuss it, the decisions on their part. I don't want to say they're wrong. Again, I haven't sat and read that big document that Robin was talking about, but just from the discussion here, it doesn't seem like the best way to do things at the very least.
I mean, just taking this a step further as well, I know we touched on other Google services going away as well, but I mean, like, YouTube is a news channel these days. I mean, I watched the U.S. inauguration on YouTube. So if a Australian publication has a YouTube channel, does that also have to disappear? Does Google have to change how searches rank there? Because that gets even messier, because there you're dealing with a very complex algorithm that I'm not even sure Google itself understands anymore. And like it, like you say, Clinton, it really does come across like there are people making these suggestions that don't maybe quite understand how the internet works and how these systems work, But then further to your point, Robin, is that, I mean, we've given all these companies this power. So are we a bit too late to kind of go, whoa, hang on, you've got way too much power. And when these companies say, well, I mean, you don't have to use our service, you kind of go, well, I do kind of, because there's nothing else.
Yeah, it reminds me of, again, we were talking about Facebook and everything last week. In South Africa, if you don't have WhatsApp, you're at a massive disadvantage. Mm. For example, say you're in any kind of job, and you're applying for a job, and your boss is, your potential boss, I should say, they say, okay, I've got your number. Listen, when we want to organize a meeting, I'll send you a WhatsApp. If you say to that guy, I don't use WhatsApp because I have a problem with Facebook's, how they deal with personal information, la-di-da-di-da, that guy will probably just not phone that candidate back. Mm. They won't send him a WhatsApp. So when they say you can't, you know, you can choose not to use our services, it's such a hollow statement, because sometimes you really can't. Sometimes the services are so ingrained into the culture in certain countries that there's just nothing you can do. You need to use WhatsApp if you want to run a business properly. And so many small business owners in South Africa, and I know we're getting away from it right now, but we'll come back to Google and everything. If you want to speak to the owner, they'll usually say, send me a WhatsApp, not an email.
Mm.
And something that's happened is that consumers are now expecting that. They expect, if they want to talk to a small business, they will have a WhatsApp line where they speak to someone.
Mm.
And it's become expected. So what do these businesses do? They can't just stop using WhatsApp, which is Facebook at the end of the day. So it's the same conversation, it feels like we're having. It's just a different service, which is Google, and it's a different place, Australia.
And further to your point, Clinton, is that these platforms have eyes on them. Like, I just to use Parler and Gab as examples, right? Sure, if you don't like Twitter, you can go and use something like Gab. You can't use Parler because it's still offline. But you can go and use something like Gab. The problem is that the number of users there compared to something like Twitter is just, it makes no sense to go to something like Gab, right? Further to that, especially with something like YouTube, like you can go and set up your own video hosting service and all that sort of stuff, and you can pay for that if you want to. But the difference between you doing that on your own and doing it on YouTube is that if you're on YouTube, you can potentially earn money by putting videos up on YouTube, rather than having to pay for your own video server, for your own, like, all the back end that goes with running your own video server. I mean, it's just like, yeah, sure, I can go and use someone else, but it comes at a massive cost to people. So it's like you say, Clinton, it is a very hollow statement to say, oh, well, I mean, if you don't like Gmail, you can use Yahoo. Sure, I guess I could, but Yahoo probably doesn't have the Google suite of products that go along with Gmail. It's just like, yeah, it's a very hollow statement. And yeah.
And to bring it back to Google, so again, I always go back to small businesses, because I think when governments and businesses talk about big businesses, when they talk about their decisions, they always say, think of the children, think of the small businesses. Mm. It's always their go-to. If you're a business and you want to make something out of nothing, you usually look at how you can improve your rankings on Google. And say you have some money to spend on advertising, there's just, I don't think there's any small business in the world that thinks, I'm going to put that money into higher search rankings on Bing.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So again, it's a hollow statement. If they are saying to small businesses, you don't need to focus on Google to move clicks on your site, kind of do, because I need to keep the lights on. And you're the best way to do that.
Yeah, and it's also affordable. Let's not forget that. Like, as much as I dislike the fact that Google and Facebook absolutely dominate the advertising industry, they are affordable compared to other solutions. So why would I not go and spend my money at the platform that gives me the most bang for my buck? Yeah, I think we've dug ourselves into a very deep hole.
Because in the past, if you were a business, your options were paying an advertising agency, which would be only classed for really big companies.
Yeah.
Or you could pay for small ads in the local newspaper or
the classifieds.
Like that. What Google and Facebook, again, we always come back because they're both essentially advertising companies at the end of the day. What they did is they decentralized the advertising space by centralizing it on themselves so they could take all the money. I'm sure lots of people have written, you know, PhD theses and everything on this, but it's funny that they gave so many people freedom to do certain things, and especially companies, and they did it by making themselves rich. Robin, you covered the story. When will we hear something more about this? Have they said?
So there's no deadline or time frame that a final decision will be reached. I think that Google are hoping that the quote unquote the courts of public opinion will kind of rally up a lot of citizens in Australia and New Zealand and kind of get their respective ministers or political leaders to kind of see the error of their ways, for lack of a better term. For right now, there is no fixed end in sight. And it looks like it's going to drag on quite a bit.
You know what's funny in that sentiment, Robin, depending on the public to help you out, is that the public usually side with these big companies that take advantage of them. Because I'm pretty sure if you went to anyone in most countries and they said, if you had to choose the government or Google, which do you like? They'll have a minute to think. And I say, you know what? Google gives me free maps and free mail and free this and free that. They did a lot of good by me as this average citizen. What does the government do? They don't fix the roads and they take my tax money. That's all they do.
Not forget that the powers that be in government often don't have an idea or a cooking clue about what is going on in the world of technology. I think we saw this recently with the hearings in the U.S. Senate, where the likes of Mark Zuckerberg and Sundar Pichai are being interviewed by senators. And the questions that these guys pose and these ladies pose is just like, what? Do you not know how this platform works? You're investigating and you have no idea how it works.
I mean, we see it locally. I can't remember which minister it was. Brendan and I were talking about this, but to refer to things which run on electricity and connect to the internet, one of the ministers called them gadgets, which is something my very elderly grandparents would call them. Who's used the word gadget?
I do, ironically, though.
Yeah, ironically, but not when you're a minister for a country making important decisions about the future of that country when it comes to tech.
Yeah.
Well, I hope they're not using it ironically, because that would be a real turn of face.
So that kind of leads me into the next thing I wanted to ask is, what happens when something like this happens in South Africa? Because as we've seen, our lawmakers here are very out of touch with what's happening in the realms of the internet. We had the FPB draft regulations that are still confusing, still out of touch. And it just doesn't bode well when I see stories like this happening in Australia. What happens when South Africa's government goes, hang on a minute, Google's taking all of our advertising money and has been for X amount of years. We need to do something about this. And generally, I find that locally, we treat problems with everything as a nail and requires a hammer. And it concerns me to see something like this, because I think that local government would just go, well, goodbye, Google.
Yeah, I was going to say, Brendan, I was waiting for you to give me a chance to jump in. Our government is too bullheaded to do anything else but just say, you don't want to play our tune? Fine, get out of the country. They would 100% not bow to Google, because I don't want to insult what do they call each other? The highness or whatever? They just don't know what's going on. And if somebody whispered in their ear that Google was doing X, Y, and Z, they would be like, get out of here, Google. We don't want to see your face. Be out of town by tonight. Man, that would be...
You really are watching a lot of The Sopranos, aren't you?
Never want to see your face in the city again. Yeah, if somebody whispered the right or the wrong things into some ministers, it would be real bad for the citizenry of South Africa. Real bad.
I mean,
and I don't even want to talk about how that links into the spread of information around elections and all that. A whole nother kettle of fish.
Yeah, the other thing I want to just touch on is, what happens when Google one day decides, well, we're packing it up. We're done. We don't want to do this anymore. Because, I mean, Google has a long history of just shuttering things when they are no longer profitable. And if they had to all of a sudden say, okay, well, we're going to start paying news corporations in Australia, and that becomes less and less and less profitable, then Google News gets shuttered, all news publications suffer, or all news publications that are part of that initiative suffer as a result. I mean, like, it's the Stadia problem, just a lot more serious, because now you're dealing with people's livelihoods and news and information, which is very valuable. Like, I just, like we said right at the top, I think we've all given like these companies a bit too much power, and now we're looking back and I'm going, okay, well, whoops, that needs to change, but is it too little too late?
Yeah, the Pandora's box has been opened, the horses have been let out of the stable, the milk has been spilled, all the metaphors. It's almost too late. And I think the only thing that would happen now is something very drastic, like a worldwide internet outage or something like that. I really think things are just going to get worse for us and better for the companies until something absolutely drastic like that happens, which is very grim to think about. And maybe don't, because it'll just make you depressed. We always end on a bad note. We always end with, we don't have all the answers. Things are probably going to get worse in the short term. We'll see you next week. We're maybe a bit too stoic on this podcast. Maybe we need to spend one podcast talking about puppies or something.
Yeah, I think so. The best dog YouTube videos or something like that. Because, man, this year is not getting off to a good start. Really, really.
It's still January. It's not even February yet.
Okay. Robin, do you have anything else you want to add before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I think probably just my prediction of how this is going to play out. I think the Australian government is going to stick to its guns, but very soon they're going to acquiesce. I think they don't actually realize just how vital Google is, or just how much power it has.
Yeah.
It might not necessarily be as visible as they are aware of, but the permutations for Google removing search and other services from your country are massive. And I think, yeah, very soon they're going to say, listen, we underestimated Google, and we're going to see if we can play nicely now.
It would probably be something like one of the government's like grandchildren. They'll be like, okay, here's Google, use it for a bit. Now here's Bing, use that for a bit. And they'll be like, oh, this is... No, I was almost sore there. This isn't as good. Okay, we'll roll back things. Or like one of the ministers will not have internet that day and they can't access their stuff. They'll be like, oh, this sucks. And then they'll have to go back to chambers or whatever and be like, okay, guys, we need to roll this back. It wasn't the best idea. Which is unfortunate because it will be a massive win for Google. So no winners for us, really.
No.
Again, we're getting real spirally here, real looking to the depth.
Yeah, I think that's a sign that we need to call it for today. Thank you so much for joining us and listening to us. What's the word?
Doomsday.
Yeah. Wax lyrically about the end of the world thanks to big tech. Thank you for joining us. Hopefully next week we have something a little bit lighter. I think we should aim for that. But who knows what the next week holds. It's January 2021. Anything could happen. But thank you so much for joining me, Clinton Matos.
It's a pleasure.
And Robin Lee Chessy.
Yep, anytime.
And we'll see you next week. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Bye. Cheers.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.